"I need a little stroll to settle my breakfast," she said amiably. But she wished her face was not coated with black cream. She hated conceding even the slightest advantage to him. As Sean walked away, her father swilled the tea leaves in his mug and flicked them out. "Don't fall for him, Tesoro. He'd be too big a handful, even for you." She stared at him, outraged and appalled. "Fall for him? Are you out of your skull, Papa? I can't stand the sight of him." "That's what I mean," he chuckled. She jumped up and threw her pack onto her back with unnecessary strength, and then told her father with disdain, "I could cope with him and five others like him with my eyes closed and one hand tied behind my back, but I've got better taste than that."
"Which is fortunate for you,"
he murmured just low enough so she was uncertain what he had said. A little before noon that day, Matatu led them into the papyrus beds which surrounded the green pool which they'd seen from the air. He led them directly to the great dished spore printed in the mud, and they gathered round to inspect it. "See," Matatu told them, "this is where Tukutila stood when he heard the Indeki coming. Here and there he turned to look up at the sky and challenge us." Matatu imitated the old bull, holding his head at the same angle, humping his back and cupping his hands at the side of his head. It was such a faithful impression that for a moment he seemed to become the old bull, and they all laughed. Claudia forgot her fatigue and clapped in applause. "Then what did the old bull do?" demanded Sean. And Matatu spun and pointed along the run of the spoor.
"He went away with all his speed. He went fast and very far."
"Well," Sean said, "that puts us almost exactly 48 hours behind him. And we have to sleep now. We'll be 55 hours behind him when we march again." Tukutila's dam had been the matriarch of a herd of over 100 beasts. She had come into her last period of estrus in her 52nd year, and after the days that it lasted she had been mounted and serviced by 6 of the herd bulls, all young mammals, vigorous, and at the height of their powers. It was the ideal formula for the conception of an extraordinary calf, old cow and young bull. Although it was uncertain which seed had taken root in her, the old cow had carried the genes of great elephants, big in body and tusk, in natural intelligence and the urge to dominate. These same genes had made her the leader of her herd, and now she transferred them to the fetus she carried in her womb. She carried him 22 months, and then in the year when the German Askaris under General von Leto Furbeck were ravaging eastern Africa, the year 1915, she had left the herd, and accompanied only by another old female past calf-bearing, her companion of 40 years, she had gone deep into the fastness of the swamps that lie in the south bank of the Zambezi River. And there, on an islet fringed with ivory nut palms, surrounded by miles of papyrus beds, and with the white-headed fish eagles chanting overhead, she had cleared an area of sandy earth for her couch. When her time came, she had spread her back legs and squatted over the open area, squealing in the agony of her labour, her trunk rolled up on her chest. Her eyes had no tear ducts to drain them, so the tears poured freely down her withered cheeks as though she wept, and the spasms racked the huge, gaunt frame. The other old cow stood close beside her like a midwife, caressing her with her trunk, stroking her back and rumbling with sympathy. She had forced out the calf's head and then rested for a minute before the last violent effort expelled the purple-pink fetal sac, and the calf had fallen to the earth, rupturing the umbilical cord. Tukutila had begun to struggle immediately, still trapped in the glistening mucus-coated membrane, and the old cow, her companion, had stood over him and with a prehensile tip of her trunk, delicately stripped it away. Then with her trunk, his dam had gently and lovingly lifted him to his feet and placed him between her front legs making the deep, purring rumble of elephant contentment. Still wet and smooth and shining pinkly from his birthing, covered in copious gingery hair, almost blind, Tukutila had rolled his little trunk back into his forehead and reached up instinctively to the twin breasts on his mother's chest. While he tasted, for the very first time, the rich, creamy milk, his dam picked up the fetal sac and afterbirth and stuffed them into her mouth, chewing and swallowing, and at the same time using her trunk to cover the damp and blood-stained spot upon the earth with sand. The three of them, his mother, her companion, and Tukutila, had remained on the island for almost 2 weeks while the calf had mastered the use of his legs and trunk. The pigment of his skin had darkened, and his eyes adjusted to the harsh African sunlight. Then, when she considered him strong enough, she had taken him to find the herd, pushing him ahead of her and lifting him over the steep and difficult places. The din of 100 elephant feeding had carried to them from afar, the crack and crash of breaking branches and the pig-like squeals of the calves in play. Tukutila's dam trumpeted her return, and the herd came rushing up to greet her. Then, discovering the new calf, they'd crowded around to touch him with their trunks, puffing his scent into their mouths so that they would recognize it always thereafter. Tukutila cowered between his mother's front legs, overwhelmed by the huge bodies that surrounded him, making little baby noises of terror. But his mother draped her trunk over him and rumbled to reassure him. Within hours rather than days, he ventured out from her protection to join the other calves and to begin carving for himself a niche in the hierarchy of the breeding herd. The herd was a close-knit group, almost all its members blood relatives, mutually reliant upon each other so that the education and discipline of the young was a concern of all. The calves were always kept in the centre of the herd, and their antics were strictly supervised by the old barren cows, who were their self-appointed nursemaids. Their care and protection was intense, but any infringement of the herd law was punished instantly. A tree branch wielded with gusto across the recalcitrant's back and hindquarters would ensure terrified squeals and instant obedience. Tukutila learned his place in every situation. At the centre, when the herd was relaxed and feeding, between his mother's front legs when they were on the march or in flight from danger, he learned to react instantly to the alarm signal, learned to recognise it even when given by an animal on the further outskirts of the group. At the signal, the instantaneous silence, in contrast to the preceding happy uproar of the herd, was an eerie phenomenon of elephant behaviour. Tukutila's development was closely parallel to the ages of a human being. His infancy lasted 2 years, during which time he shed the tiny milk tusks with which he'd been born, and then entered on his juvenile years when his true tusks emerged beyond his lips. At first these were covered by a cap of smooth enamel, but as soon as he was weaned and began to use his tusks to feed with, and in mock combat with his peers, this was worn away, and the true ivory beneath exposed. His tusks would continue to grow in length and girth throughout his entire life, even into his extreme old age. But the genes which dictated their extraordinary development came down from his dam along with all other gifts of strength and bulk and intelligence. By the age of 3, Tukutila had learned the attitudes of threat and submission towards others, and his play was boisterous, with much ear-flapping and threatening and barging, which further developed his unusually robust frame. Once his dam weaned him, her care became less intensive, and he was allowed more range and freedom, though he still came under her fierce protection at the first threat, and on the march his place was close beside her in the lead, so very early on he learned the herd's territory. This was a vast area, from the shores of Lake Nyasa in the north to the rainforests of the Chimanimani Mountains in the south, west to the deep gorge where the Zambezi River forces itself between narrow rock cliffs with a roar of perpetual thunder, and east, 500 miles, to where the same mighty river spreads out across wide floodplains and swampy littoral before debouching through multiple mouths into the Indian Ocean. He learned the mountain passes and the ancient elephant roads. He learned the groves where succulent fruits grew and the seasons when they ripened. She led him to burned-out savannas just as the first tender green shoots pushed through the ashes, and to the salt licks where, for thousands of years, the elephants had come to prize out lumps of mineral-rich earth with their tusks and eat it with all the relish of small boys with sticks of candy, over the centuries quarrying deep excavations in the red African earth. The herd was on the Mavura Donha Mountains in the south, when the Msasa forests put out new leaf and their sap began to flow. They were in the dense rainforests on Mount Mlanje when the rest of the range baked in the long African droughts. Always the old cow led them to water, for the herd was totally dependent upon that precious fluid. They must drink each day or experience terrible hardship. They needed copious quantities to nurture their great bodies, to cleanse their hides, and, more simply, for the luxurious pleasure of the wallow. The watering hole was an important gathering place for the herd, a place where their bonds were reaffirmed, and where many of the rituals of their social behaviour was played out. Even the act of procreation usually took place in the water, and when the cows chose the place for their birthing, it was nearly always near water. Sometimes there was abundant water, the great green African rivers, the mountains upon which the perpetual drizzling rains fell, and the wide swamplands where they waded belly-deep through papyrus beds to reach the islands. At other times they had to dig for it in the dry river beds, or patiently wait their turn at the seeps to thrust their trunks into the deep eye of the secret well and suck up a bitter, brackish mouthful at a time. Their range was wide, and their contact with human beings infrequent. There was a great war raging in a far-off land, and it had sucked most of the white men to its centre. The men that the herd encountered were usually half-naked and primitive tribesmen who fled before them. Yet Tukutila learned very early that a special aura of dread surrounded these strange, hairless, baboon-like beings. At 5 years of age, he could identify their peculiar acrid odour on a light breeze from many miles away, and even the faintest taint of it made him and the entire herd uneasy. Yet Tukutila was 11 years of age before he had his first memorable encounter with human beings. One night, while following their time-honoured route along the south bank of the Zambezi, his dam had stopped abruptly at the front of the herd and lifted her trunk at full stretch above her head to scent the air. Tukutila had imitated her and become aware of a tantalizing odour. He had puffed the taste of it into his mouth, and his saliva poured down and dribbled from his lower lip. The rest of the herd bunched up behind them and were almost immediately consumed by the same appetite. None of them had ever smelled sugar cane before. The old matriarch led them up the wind, and within a few miles they came out on an area of the river bank that had been recently cleared and irrigated and planted with cane. The long, sword-shaped leaves glistened in the moonlight, and the aroma was rich and sweet and irresistible. The herd rushed into the new fields, pulling up the plants and stuffing them down their throats in greedy passion. The destruction was immense, and in the midst of it, suddenly the herd was surrounded by lights and the shouts of men's voices and the beating of drums and metal cans. Panic and pandemonium overtook the herd, and as they charged out of the field, there was a shocking series of loud reports and the bright flash of gunfire in the night. It was the first time Tukutila had ever smelled burned cordite smoke. He would remember it always, and associate it with squeals of the elephants who had been mortally hit.